So, in the last couple of interviews, a number of people have expressed the experience of having come to the retreat and settling in pretty easily, and then having this kind of honeymoon period where everything was flowing along, and then encountering suddenly difficulty of some sort or another. Dealing with intense emotions or doubt or restlessness or just that feeling that the practice has kind of stalled out and isn't going anywhere. And it can be very helpful at times like this to go back to the original teachings, to see what the Buddha said about the practice, and to get some guidance and inspiration from that. And even if the practice is going quite well, the suttas, these original teachings, can yield a lot of useful advice about how to keep the practice deepening. So most nights we've been chanting the Metta Sutta in English. And today I want to take the beginning of this as a kind of a jumping off point to talk about some of the qualities and some of the attitudes that support the deepening and continuity of the metta practice. The other day, Sayadaw talked about what metta people do. And the beginning of the Metta Sutta describes how metta people are. So at the outset, I want to give you just a little bit of context about this. The Buddha offered this Metta Sutta to a group of monks who had come to him in quite a bit of distress. It's a long and slightly delicious story that I won't tell today because I know a lot of you know it already. But suffice it to say, they were really stressed out about their practice. They came to him in the middle of the rains retreat when they had no business traveling. Monks during the rains retreat stay in one place. But they up sticks and left and went to the Buddha and said, we can't practice. And the Metta Sutta was what the Buddha offered them as a safeguard, a protection, and as a meditation subject. It's quite a condensed teaching. And at first, perhaps you're having this experience as we chant it. At first, when you look at it, it seems like a bit of a hodgepodge, we say in English, a little of this and a little of that, and there doesn't seem to be any real kind of uniting thread other than the metta itself. But as the sutta develops, it's a graduated teaching. So the Buddha starts at the ground level and proceeds step by step from how we are in the world in the general sense through the development of concentration and ultimately leading to freedom of mind. And it's a teaching that along the way touches all three of the main limbs of the Buddha's teaching: sila, ethical conduct; samadhi, the development of concentration and the development of the practice; and punya, wisdom. And Mahasi Sayadaw calls these three limbs of the practice the best advantages to be gained in the long journey through samsara, through the round of existence. And the Metta Sutta covers every one of them. I don't want to go into these three limbs in any detail today, just to give you that as context. Because otherwise it's very easy to dismiss bits and pieces of this teaching as unimportant. But really, Buddhas, enlightened beings, don't speak as we worldlings do. Every word is there for a reason. Every part of the teaching is there for a reason. It's all important. So this afternoon, I want to touch on the very first of these limbs, sila, ethical conduct. And I want to expand on the very beginning of the sutta, the part that talks about our lives, about how we live in the world, and how we as yogis can support or undermine the practice. And I want to offer a word of caution at the outset. And please take this in. Because it's very, very easy to take this advice in the wrong way. So please take this first part of this sutta, this teaching, as the map of the inner landscape of one who is awake, one who has perfected loving kindness, describing an area to investigate and explore in the practice, a place to develop, rather than a list of things that you have to get perfect before you can begin the practice. The Buddha meant this list as a resource, not a weapon of self-judgment. And I like to imagine the setting of this sutta, the Buddha speaking to all of these monks, and they were said to be very good monks, not slackers. And so he gave this at the very beginning, almost as an affirmation, as though to say, you know, you guys, you are really on the way. You have all these qualities. They may have been shaken at the time by fear and by doubt. But the opening verses are actually a heartfelt statement of encouragement and affirmation. All of those 500 monks would have had these qualities to some extent. And so it is for us, all of us. We may not feel that we are perfect. We may not feel like we've even scratched the surface of these qualities, but we all have them to some extent or another, or we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be practicing. We wouldn't have taken time away from our regular life, come all the way here to Myanmar. We wouldn't have taken that leap. So please take this as an encouragement and an affirmation and a place to explore and polish rather than another tool for self-judgment. So first, I want to talk in general about sila, ethical conduct, the precepts that we take every day. And they are specifically a metta practice, creating a field of protection for us personally and for everybody around us. This is the realm of metta in speech and metta in action. The chant we did the other night articulates, and which I know Ariya will be talking about more later. And it can help that to understand that just by holding the precepts, without uttering a single phrase to ourselves, without saying even once, may I be well, happy, and peaceful, that we are doing the metta practice. At the same time, concurrently, metta practice, meditation practice, depends on sila as its ground and its foundation. Without holding the precepts, the mind cannot be quiet, will be filled with remorse or regret. So it's an essential part of the practice. And it's not just about avoiding the obvious ways we might break our precepts. No one here is going around killing other beings or going into people's rooms and stealing something. But it's the subtle, more refined ways that we hold the precepts that can count. The other night, Saito was telling Mimi, Ariya, and I about how he never takes antibiotics. And we said, oh, why? And he said, panatipata, harming living beings. I wasn't quite sure whether this was a joke or if he was serious, but I think at some level he was. We don't unnecessarily harm living beings. So if a mosquito lands on us, we don't swat it. We might feel like swatting the flies, but we don't. We let them out. We think before we take something. And there are many, many refined ways of holding the precepts, the precept of not taking what isn't given. Perhaps that means when there's a sign on the table that says, take one first time through in the dining room, we don't take two, even though we want to. Or perhaps if somebody's doing something that bothers us, it really annoys us, we don't write them a note, we don't speak to them, we maintain noble silence as a way of holding the precept about right speech. So the precepts in themselves are a form of metta practice. But mostly I want to talk today about conduct in the broader sense. Because the first lines of the Metta Sutta approach conduct from a slightly different direction, a slightly different angle. Not about the precepts specifically, but more about in the sense of the qualities we need to fully support the development of loving kindness. So the entire first verses of the sutta begin at the ground level with a series of 15 points that relate very, very much to our mundane lives. They're basically guidelines about how to live in accord with our deepest aspiration. This is what we need to do if we're reaching for freedom. This is virtue in the very general sense. If we want peace, if we want to be happy, this is the Buddha's prescription for that. And it's his prescription for a kind of happiness that in turn that can be supportive condition for the arising of the deepest peace. Because loving kindness is not only developed in formal sitting and in formal walking practice at the level of mind, but also in all the activities of our day, the physical activities, the mental activities, our speech, our attitude. And if our practice on the cushion seems to be going quite well, but the loving kindness isn't manifesting in our outward behavior, that's a good indication of where the metta needs to be developed. So using our speech, our action, as a litmus test really is valuable information to have. We may not really want to notice it. We may not like the information we receive. But at least we know where we need to do more practice. So looking at this list of qualities, you can look at your chant sheets, the very beginning. I'm not going to touch on all of them because it's actually quite an extensive list. But I want to highlight a few that I think are especially important. The first is honesty. And in the Pali verse, this aspect of honesty is covered by two expressions side by side, uju cha, suju cha, which literally means straight, quite straight, or very straight. And just as in English, I don't know about German, but just as in English, the Pali word uju has that double meaning. Not only physical straightness, but also integrity. It literally means straight, direct, straightforward, honest, upright. And this honesty applies both to how we relate to ourselves inwardly, as well as to how we relate to others outwardly. So it can be very good to reflect without self-judgment, but just to look. What do we take for granted about how we are? Are we seeing ourselves idealistically, judgmentally? What colors our perceptions of ourselves? And of course, externally, in terms of our physical and verbal behavior, how are we presenting ourselves to others? Are we offering a sanitized image of ourselves? Is there pretense? Or are we talking ourselves down? Are we dismissing ourselves? This engages the whole realm of image, self-image, image we present to the world. And it can be a real challenge for us to work with, because to a large extent, especially Western society, rewards image, rewards the cultivation of a certain kind of front that might not be real. But of course, in the end, cultivating all that is not a source of happiness, nor is it a source of loving kindness. The affairs of the world right now illustrate this on a massive level. So very personally, it can be a huge relief to put this down. It's one of the reasons it's such a wonderful thing to put our devices aside during a retreat. There's no Facebook, there's no Twitter, there's no even email. We can just be ourselves without anything and live from that place. We don't have to keep track of any spin we put on anything. But at the same time, please notice how you're talking to yourself. Do you have an internal Facebook feed that you're presenting to yourself about yourself? Not to judge this, but simply to notice it. Because when we notice something like this, it's not the place we're living from. It's not enslaving us or driving the train. This is what disengages it, is to observe it. So notice how you're talking to yourself about the practice. Are you talking it up? Are you talking it down? And in as much as possible, just let that kind of be in the background and just keep doing the metta practice. You can say, oh, thank you for sharing. And, you know, this kind of stuff, this commentary that we all have, it's a universal tendency. We talk to ourselves about the practice. But it's really not worth listening to. Simply rest in the cultivation of loving kindness, the repetition of the phrase. Rest in the heart with this offering of friendly well-wishing over and over and over again, including all that, but not following it, not feeding it. So in this context, the next quality, the next aspect that I want to address is the line that talks about without pride. Pride or strong conceit. Specifically means pride taken to excess. It can be overt arrogance. It can also mean the opposite version, which is extreme self-judgment. And it's obvious how either form of pride or conceit, negative or positive, make metta practice difficult. Arrogance hurts others. It puts them down. It discriminates against them. And the harm of self-judgment is obvious. We feel it in our experience. And each of these states is antithetical to metta. It's the opposite of metta. They work in opposition to the state of peace, the state of friendliness, and the state of benevolence that we're trying to cultivate. And this actually goes quite deeply, because conceit in the technical sense, in the Buddhist technical sense of Buddhist psychology, always involves the construction of a self. And I don't want to talk much about this today, because I'm really kind of gestating a talk about self conceit and metta. So I want to spend more time later about this. Except to say that because metta bhavana, the cultivation of loving kindness, is relational, we begin to see this in our practice. And we begin to see that in order to place value and emphasis on another person, we have to reduce the emphasis on me, mine, the ego. So the metta bhavana works in this arena. And the more we can incline to the simplicity of humility, the easier the practice will be. The next aspect I want to go to, and you know, really all of these are tied together. It's hard to talk about one without talking about all of the others. So this is kind of all blends. But the next aspect is that of contentment. In your translation, the English translation from Amaravati, it says content and easily satisfied. And the quality of contentment is so precious. It's said in the Dhammapada to be the greatest wealth. It's deeply supportive of a quiet mind and allows the practice to go smoothly, regardless of what we have, regardless of what we don't have. Conditions aren't ever perfect. Unenlightened people are never perfect. And if we can kind of surrender to this as gracefully as possible, it makes for a lot more peace and a lot more ease. We can relax rather than having a rigid stance of how things ought to be or should be or must be. In the last couple of years, I've spent a couple of weeks each year walking the Camino de Santiago in Spain as a metta practice. And it's a wonderful opportunity for me to get out of my Buddhist bubble and experience how other people practice. And there's a saying you often hear on the Camino, which is, tourists demand, pilgrims are grateful. So on the journey of retreat, are we tourists or are we pilgrims? Are we tourists needing this and that, demanding this and that? Or do we receive what we have with gratitude. And in this context, when I use the word demand, please understand, I don't mean for any of you that activity of going to the dining room or the office repeatedly demanding something. No one here is doing that. It's okay to go to the office if you need something. I mean actually something much more subtle and hard to detect. What I mean when I use the word demand is what we call in English entitlement. And contentment is the opposite of entitlement. And I use that word entitlement to mean that assumption that it's our right or our privilege to have something or to control something. It can pertain to things, having things, people, space, controlling either one of them. And Saito once said something that deeply touched me about this. He was speaking to all of us down in the Yangon Center one time before he left to go on a trip. And he said, "No one here owns anything, not even me." And by extension, what he meant was none of us had any reason to think that we deserved anything more than what was being offered. Upandita, who was my preceptor and a beloved teacher, put it this way, and there was a sign in the office at Semengon. I don't know if it's still there. It says, "No one here is special." So it applies to when we think that for whatever reason, others have to behave in a way that suits us. That we have the right to control what happens in communal space. One aspect of retreat experience that's always a little bit interesting is that we all have to live here together, and we don't have identical preferences. So when these preferences collide, it can get quite interesting. There's a phenomena called yogi mind, which is what happens as a retreat begins to deepen, as concentration begins to develop. But when there are still a lot of kilesa, hindrances, or defilements floating around. And the nature of these two mind states together is that the kilesa distort our experience and the concentration magnifies that distortion. So suddenly things that we would normally not be bothered by turn into huge dramas. Which is why noble silence is so very, very important here on retreat. Because when our preferences collide is when these dramas can play out. It's very, very common. It's kind of one of those things in any retreat center, at least in the West. They're often protocols for what to do, for example, with the windows. And there are signs everywhere. These are to stay closed. These you can open. There are policies to prevent window wars. Some people like it hot. Some people like it cold. And, you know, so somebody opens a window, somebody shuts the window, somebody opens the window, somebody slams the window shut. All of this in silence. Or perhaps the person next to us is breathing loudly. I can't concentrate. That person is being so inconsiderate. Or maybe they step a little too heavily. Thump, 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 thump. That person, they're not thinking of the rest of us. You know, we get caught in these loops of distortion and magnification. Or we want to own our walking space. I had a very interesting experience of this once at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. I was sitting a 3-month retreat, and it was early in the retreat, so everybody was just kind of establishing their routine. And I thought, you know, I'd like to go outside and do some walking out in the meadow. So I found a path, and I started walking there. And I'm walking, and I turn around and open my eyes, and there's someone coming down the path towards me. And she stops. And you could see she was narrowing her eyes. It was about as far away as from me to the door. And I thought, oh, this is her spot. And instead of turning around and going somewhere else, she then walked very quickly towards me. And it was a narrow little path. And then at the last minute, you know, went around me very quickly. Stop, 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 stop. And I'm like, and then she went back in the other direction and then disappeared. And I thought, whoa, road rage. That's what it felt like. And I was, even early in the retreat, I was pretty sensitive. And it was like, it shook me up quite a bit. So things we do when we react to other people can go in quite deeply. This is why not to write that note that says, with metta. With metta. Because it never is really with metta. We should write it with aversion. Truthfully yours. And definitely why not to talk to each other. So if something bothers you that somebody does, maybe not thoughtfully, maybe they're being inconsiderate. That's okay. We're all people here. Is it possible to use that to deepen the metta practice? To incline to flexibility and group harmony rather than making things fit our ideas of the way things have to be? Mostly these things are not our business, but we make them so. There's a metaphor in the texts of the proper gochara in Pali, the proper pasture for a yogi, which is simply to do the practice, basically. And trouble comes in meditative communities when, because of entitlement of some sort or another, we stray out of our appropriate pasture. And a few of you may have noticed this morning, after the group sit, a literal example of how challenging this can be. Somebody was coming down the road there with a whole group of cows. It was a small group of people and a larger group of cows, and they decided to leave the road and go mingle with the other ones on the other side. And one of them kind of jumped into the compound over the forest path. And, you know, it was kind of bovine havoc. It can be the same in our communities when we leave our proper pasture. So the best advice is simply to mind your own business. take care of the practice, and do the metta practice in all situations. Of course, it goes without saying that if some harm is actually being done, some physical or emotional harm, do not hesitate to talk to one of us, to Ariya, to myself, to Sayadaw, to Mimi. But please don't talk to each other. So that's one aspect of contentment. Not acting from entitlement. Another aspect is really pertains to our general physical surroundings. And it's addressed by the next part of the instruction, which is another translation saying easily maintained, not doing too much, lightly engaged. Contentment and not doing too much are directly linked. And in the context of a retreat, it can be really, really good to watch this. Especially as the retreat deepens and the continuity is generally becoming established, being lightly engaged, not doing too much, really deepens the practice. And if we get to a kind of a place where the practice is going along for a long period of time, just a steady state, it can very much help to watch and to see what might be creating that stasis. An example from my own experience, during a long retreat, I was getting frustrated by the practice. It was going along, it was okay, but I wasn't seeing anything new. And then one morning I thought, well, what's going on here? And I reflected and thought, well, okay, every morning I had been going to make a pot of tea. I'm very attached to my pot of tea. I love tea. So after breakfast, because my yogi job was any time, I had time to make a nice pot of Assam tea, and I had my milk powder, and I could go to my room and savor my little pot of tea. And I realized it was taking an hour to make the tea, to drink the tea, to prepare the night before so that I had a little flask of milk in my room for the tea. It was just tea. It wasn't at all important. And it was creating a big hole in my kind of continuity balloon. I was practicing through that, but it was doing too much. And when I dropped the tea, both because of the caffeine that I was missing and because of the extra almost 1 hour to actually practice, the practice again began to pick up momentum. So notice in your daily routine when you're doing something that might not be necessary. And take care not to be busy with small, unimportant things. Because they can be a distraction that really disrupts the concentration and breaks the continuity of the loving kindness. And also here in Myanmar, take particular care not to get involved with thoughts in trying to fix or organize the way things are here. No doubt you've noticed that things are different than they are at home. And Sayadaw often says to yogis when they come on retreat, right at the outset, he says, please be patient. Things are different here. And, you know, there's so many things that are different. The food is different. The climate is different. The customs are different. The amount of trash is different. The values are different. Things are less organized than many of us are used to, less regimented. So it can be unsettling. We really want to fix or kind of create a place that kind of works in a way that we feel comfortable with, we feel used to, we feel familiar with. But contentment in this context means not trying to change the way things are, letting Burma simply be Burma. Not trying to adjust our outer environment to suit our preferred comfort zone. And what happens if we can do this is this lovely relaxation. It allows a settling of the mind and directly reduces any restlessness or seeking. It's important to discern the difference between what we want and what we need. If we really need something, we need to take care of that. If we want something, that's something to let go of. So the very end of this section says, one would not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And this is kind of the capstone of this entire section. It covers all aspects of conduct. And it refers to doing our best to live faultlessly. Holding whatever ethical precepts we hold, but also in general, to take great care in how we behave, both in public and in private. This is actually, living faultlessly is actually a very high bar and a very high standard of conduct, regardless of the precepts we hold. It requires care, sensitivity, wise attention, and being willing to take correction from the wise if it's offered, without getting defensive, without trying to justify ourselves. And it's really not easy to stay open in such a situation. I mean, nobody likes to be corrected. But provided that the source of the correction is wise, this is a wonderful opportunity to drop an old habit that gets in the way of loving kindness. And it allows us to adjust ourselves so that we're more in alignment with where we want to be. And living faultlessly also comes from an understanding of kamma, of karma. An understanding that actions have consequences. From the Tibetan tradition, Padmasambhava said this, although my view is as vast as the sky, my attention to the law of karma is as fine as barley flour. I really love that because it expresses the quality of heartfelt continuity that we need when we pay attention to our speech, to our action, the care we need to take. It addresses how we need to be sensitive, kind, empathetic, inclining to the wholesome, not to the ego. So these are just a few of those qualities. I encourage you to look at the entire verse at some point. They all come together in one place, actually. You can't, as I said, talk about one without really involving all of the others. And again, to remind you that the Buddha was not saying we should or we have to have any of them. It's not like we take this ideal and we try to force ourselves to be that way. That actually isn't straightness, it isn't truthfulness. He was simply directing our attention to those qualities that support loving kindness, those qualities to feed and to polish. And another articulation of all of these, when you look at the list, is actually the list of the 10 paramis, the 10 perfections, that are qualities of heart and mind that are polished by a bodhisattva, someone who has taken the vow to become a Buddha. And these, by definition, are actually polished and develop over eons, a very long period of time, not just a few weeks or a month. The commentaries say that in order to polish the paramis, we need at the minimum 4 incalculables and 100,000 great eons. So 4 incalculables and 100,000 great eons, we can let ourselves off the hook if we're not perfect. It takes some time. So please give yourselves a break. This is not a place to demand immediate perfection. Rather, it's the direction to aim the heart. And as you pay attention to these qualities and perfect them, you'll begin to notice that they and loving kindness mutually reinforce each other. The more the loving kindness is present, the easier it is to be kind, considerate, calm, humble, thoughtful. And the more we do all of that, the easier it is to cultivate the metta, and the more metta we can cultivate. And you can see how this is an upward leading spiral. So it's not a one-way street, but a complex feedback loop between the way we are in the world and the cultivation of loving kindness in the practice that goes higher and higher until the heart is completely open and at ease with the entirety of experience and all the beings in it. So I want to end today with a couple of lovely quotes from the Samyutta Nikaya. They come from different places, but I think they go very beautifully together and really nicely articulate what we've been talking about today. So the Buddha says, regarding the Dhamma thus shown by me in different ways, if there are those who understand what is rightly said and rightly spoken, It may be expected of them that they will live in concord and unity, without dispute, blending like milk and water, looking at each other with kindly eyes. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will develop and cultivate the liberation of mind by loving kindness. Make it our vehicle. Make it our basis. Stabilize it. Exercise ourselves in it and fully perfect it. Thus, you should train yourselves. So may we all be able to exercise ourselves in this beautiful practice, to stabilize it, and to fully protect it, and to fully perfect it.